purposes continued after 1973. The charge became then that the South Vietnamese were sabotaging the agreement, aided and abetted by the United States. The fact was Hanoi accepted the agreement in the first place only because it was really so bloodied and dispirited that it could no longer continue big unit warfare. It needed to buy time to regroup. In the expectation that the marginal advance that would come out of the ceasefire agreement would come out of it for them. And when it saw the opportunity to achieve unification with one swift stroke, without hesitation, it abrogated the agreement, and you really should not have expected them to do anything else but that. All right, the third conclusion on negotiated settlements in Indochina is that an agreement can never exceed its own substance, and that to the extent it is flawed, to that extent there will be failure in implementation. Again, I hope they remember that with Cambodia. Indochina has been particularly cursed by flawed agreements. All three of the major ones in this century carried in them the seeds of their own destruction. The 1954 Geneva Agreement, as you have heard me say, perhaps ad nauseum, was a gross act of international irresponsibility. The French, after 100 years of colonialism, simply walked away from the place, unconcerned, unlike, say, the British in India, unconcerned about any kind of tutelage period for the transfer of sovereignty. The chief meaning of Geneva in 54 was that it set the stage for the subsequent Vietnam War, probably made it inevitable. The best, I guess you can say, in defense of the French was, after having fought a long war, you could reasonably say they might reasonably say you could not expect them to behave otherwise, although I would say they should have behaved otherwise. Hanoi's treatment of the 1961 Laos agreements proceeded from the same principle that governed its behavior later and earlier. It looked on Laos in terms of serving the cause of unification. That's the only thing it looked on Laos in terms of, I would say. It would agree to nothing that mitigated against this. It was indifferent to anything else. Now, they needed, Hanoi vitally needed the Laotian rite of passage, the famed Ho Chi Minh Trail, which went through Laos almost entirely. It had to have it to supply the war in the south. Simply had to have it. Nothing else mattered much, at least for them at the time being. North Vietnamese did not particularly care about the governmental arrangement that was reached in Geneva for Laos itself, the so-called Three Princes solution of a left-wing, right-wing, and a centrist Lao prince, all related to each other, that formed this three princes solution. I'll tell you one story of Dennis Warner, the Australian journalist and writer, told me the story about sitting on the platform in Vientiane at the time that this three princes solution government was inaugurated. And he was sitting next to a colonel, a Polish colonel, who was a member of the ICC, the International Control Commission, who was monitoring him. This was a guy right out of Warsaw. He was an ex-coal miner and a very proletarian type. He had a head like a jug, and Dennis said, and so at the, and, you know, he thought he was probably quite a stolid, stunned type. And was much surprised when he turned to the colonel and he said, "Tell me, Colonel, do you think that this Three Princes government is going to work?" And the colonel said, "This isn't a government, this is a comic opera." And I think that pretty much was the attitude, right or wrong, of all the foreigners about Laos, that they didn't really care about it. Wasn't all that important. They had certain narrow vested interests, and this certainly applies to the Vietnamese, and I would say it applies to the Vietnamese today. that I think people grossly exaggerate how much Hanoi wants to run things in Laos. I don't think they really do at all. They have a few limited interests, and as long as they're served, that's it. And in this case, the only thing they really wanted was access to the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And the Laos Agreement of 62 said, and they signed this, they agreed to it, but for what it meant, Laos is to become a neutral state. There is to be no intrusion into Laos by any outside foreign military forces. Completely neutral. And of course, I suppose their thinking is that we're not really intruding into Laos, we're just on our way through. At any rate, it was a case where they had to have the place, and so the notion that we could somehow get them to sign a piece of paper that we would stop going through Laos says more about us, I think, than it does about them. The 73 Paris Agreement was the most flawed of all. It settling nothing and solving nothing, and in all probability, and this is what still being argued, in all probability what it really did, certainly for the South Vietnamese, possibly for the U.S., was to snatch defeat out of the jaws of victory. That's the theme that's now being advanced by William Colby and Kissinger, and probably will be picked up by a number of historians. That we had the war won in 73, then we went to Paris and threw it all down the tube. Well, that can be argued either way. I'm not saying that, but all I'm saying here is that the Paris agreements were badly flawed if you thought that they were going to end the war in a satisfactory manner. Obviously, they didn't end it, so that's proof positive. Now, there is a common pattern here. Agreements which are rooted in unreality, agreements which presume unobtainable or impossible conditions, and agreements with unenforceable supervisory arrangement, unworkable verification mechanisms, and finally, agreements without moral suasion or legal force as operative factors. That's the characteristic of all of these peace agreements in Indochina, including the last one. They were rooted in unreality. They were based on the assumption of unobtainable or impossible conditions. They had unenforceable supervisory mechanisms or unworkable verification mechanisms, and they did not have the moral suasion or legal force which must really be behind any kind of contract or legal agreement. There has to be something beyond the law, beyond force, in which all the parties simply accept as a moral responsibility to observe them. And in this case, nobody on any side really did. All right, fourth point then, I think it is the fourth, isn't it? All right, this is what I want. Yeah, every agreement is one of a kind. A country's heritage, its character of its political culture, and the mindset of its leadership, these are the things that shape whether an agreement is acceptable to it, and it figures very prominently in subsequent adherence or lack of it. Political culture, the historical experiences, the thinking of the leadership. These are sort of intangibles, but they're very important, and they really do are what determine whether there is going to be adherence or not. There are cases where the leadership will adhere to an agreement when it really hurts, when they are paying a very high price, too high a price, they would say. But all things considered, we think maybe we should stay on. Well, you don't find that anywhere in Asia, I would say. Certainly not in Vietnam, on either side. There is an obvious relationship between the nature of a society, including the character of its government, and the treatment it affords agreements reached with others. History of agreements reached by the Vietnamese is sort of one step down a descending staircase. No agreement has ever led either to permanent peace or to improved conditions. Each was the prelude to a still greater time of troubles and further bloodshed. So it's hard to believe how any Vietnamese, whatever his political outlook, would have much faith in negotiated settlements. It's also equally clear that Vietnam was a singular society, product of an unusual ancient heritage and extraordinary recent historical influences. Long been dominated by the politics of clandestinism, which certainly works against any kind of negotiated settlement, there's been little experience or appetite for open agreements openly arrived at. Woodrow Wilson's famous hope after World War I. The opponent in negotiations is to be manipulated and deceived, to be tricked, certainly not to be dealt with in a forthright manner. So in this century, Vietnam has suffered deeply from this social pathology, buffeted by warfare and human suffering. So the question is then, what is the connection between these two factors? That is, the attitude toward agreements with others and this kind of warped socio-political condition. The answer is not really clear. What is clear that is, in such an intimate relationship, you must always bear in mind that there are these negative, positive forces at work. And they were certainly an integral part of the 1973 Paris agreements. I've got a lot more here that I'm not sure really is worth dealing with. What they have to do basically is with the fact of competing perceptions, and what the first of which, and I guess I should note that I already have noted it, is the fundamental question of these competing perceptions. One perception is that a true negotiated settlement always was obtainable, and the other basic perception is that it was not. And out of that then came the perception, on the one hand, that peace was consistently betrayed throughout the whole war, as opposed to the competing perception that it was a chimera to think that it was obtainable. And all this was just a smoke and mirrors game, and it never really was possible. Even after the war, I don't think that we can still establish this with any certainty.
Would it be reasonable to assume that Kissinger's main objective in 73 was just to get us out?
Right. And he so more or less. So.
Therefore, any settlement really would have been almost acceptable as long as it let us
save
face.
Well, it depends on what is acceptable. That was the argument. I mean, that wasn't just Kissinger. This was Nixon. And as we saw, Nixon, I mean, the 68 elections was over who the two Democrat-Republican contenders both said we were going to get out of Vietnam. Each said, I can do it better and more costly, less loss, and so on than the other guy can. So the election, as far as the war was concerned, came down to which of the two had the most credibility in being able to do this. But the word victory was erased from the rhetoric, and Nixon then came with this monkey on his back, which was to get us out of the war, and that was his instructions to Kissinger, and you know, this was not anything subterranean. It was simply the notion the war was extracting too high a price. We simply had to divest ourselves of it, and what we want to do is to do it under the best possible circumstances. And the real question now is, in evaluating this, is an assessment of it, is were these the best possible circumstances or not? And I don't think history is even at the starting gate of deciding that. I worked for Henry Kissinger in policy planning after the war, in 1975, the last days of the war, and then at the end. And I'd seen him and known him sort of casually over the years. Have I told you this story of my first meeting with Henry Kissinger? And I say, if you believe that, you don't know anything about Vietnam, and I wonder how much you know about anything else. Can you imagine saying that? Well, this was when he was just another Harvard professor, and we'd had Harvard professors through Vietnam by the dozen, and we were not impressed, as the joke goes. There was this dinner, and they had a bunch of people like me there, the Indians, but specialists on various things, and he was saying, in effect, he didn't put it this way, but the net effect which drew my response was, all Brezhnev has to, or I guess it was Khrushchev in those days, has to do to end the war is just pick up the phone and call Ho Chi Minh and say, knock it off, and hang up. And that was my response. And what you had at work there was this, European political and historical thinking. This is the way Kissinger thought. This is Metternich thinking. This is 18th century European diplomacy thinking. Big countries tell little countries what to do, especially if they're their allies. That's the way it is. And Kissinger, I think, never really could get his mind around the notion that a little country could tell a big country what to do. Particularly when he was teaching at Harvard, he didn't. After he got into government and got buffeted and went through the drill of trying to tell little countries like South Vietnam what to do, and they didn't do it, and leaning on the Russians to tell their little countries what to do, and the Russians saying, we're doing it, but they're not doing it. Don't blame us. Second time I saw Kissinger, he remembered this. He was in the White House then, and he said, in effect, I really did believe that that big countries tell little countries what to do. I believe that the Russians, when I told them, said, why don't you lean on, in the name of detente and so on, on the North Vietnamese to negotiate a settlement of the war. And they began immediately saying, well, we can't do that. We've tried to do this. We really want to do it. We have told the Vietnamese to do this, but they won't do it. He said, I just frankly didn't believe them. After about 2 years now, I'm beginning to think maybe they are not just diddling me. They are right. A year ago, I was in Moscow for a conference and with the Russians. We've had these off and on for 10 years now. And I was, and we were talking about peace in Cambodia, and some of the hardline Americans there were saying, why don't you Russians lean on the Vietnamese to lean on Hun Sen and Heng Samrin to settle in Cambodia? And they were saying, we have tried to do this, but they don't really listen to us. And I said, mild defense, I don't want to be seen here as a pro-Hanoi type, but the fact is that they're right, they don't have that kind of power. And at the break then, the head of the Russian delegation, a guy named Kapitsa, had been the desk officer on all through the Vietnam War in the foreign ministry. And he came over and grabbed me by the shoulder. And he was so happy that I'd said this. But he said, you were so right. All through the war, we were telling them to do this or do that, and they never paid any attention to us. They are very difficult people to deal with. Well, he might have been doing a slight number on me too, but the fact was that this was the central problem, I think, and it's a central question here on whether you can solve this, whether the surrogates, the outsiders, have the power to deliver. And it's very much the question in Cambodia today, whether outsiders have the power to deliver the contending Khmer elements. Yeah.
Well, didn't the Soviets supply a lot of military aid?
Right. Right. Then the price they would have paid would have been an enormous one in terms of their relations with all of their surrogates, the East Europeans and Cuba and so on. I think that. Also, it's a demonstrable fact that nobody has really been able to play that game. We couldn't do it with the South Vietnamese, and nobody, Chinese, have never been able to do this with the Vietnamese or the Russians. No, I think it's a mistake to over-exaggerate how much, the basic concept is you're not helping them just to be nice, you're helping them because it's in your national interest. So you run a bluff, you say, if you don't behave the way we want, we're going to hold back supplies. their reaction is, well, that's going to hurt you as much as it does us, and we think it's a bluff, and so we'll call your bluff. Go ahead. And so then you back down. I mean, that's the prospect. And of course, the fear of being of a bluff being called is why it isn't made in the first place. And maybe you could get away with it, but in the back in the home office, there is just isn't the willingness to take that chance. I'm trying to think of what else I wanted to say about Kissinger and the settlement. Oh, yeah. Well, then years later, when I went to work for Kissinger in policy planning, the director of policy planning was a fellow named Winston Lord, who had been with Kissinger right at his elbow. He was a China watcher, and he's married to a Chinese. He knows China quite well. Runs the Foreign Relations Council in New York now. But he had the trust of Kissinger, and he knew he was there through everything. And so this was then years later. I remember having a long session with him in which I said, you know, during this period of 73, people would come through Saigon who was seeing Kissinger in Paris and in Washington, and we were getting different reports. And these were people who were very close to him. I mean, not necessarily journalists, but government officials and so on. And some of them were saying, Kissinger is very cynical about this Paris Agreement. He calls it a fig leaf, a decent interval. He has no faith in it whatsoever. It's just designed to get us out of the war. It's designed to buy us a little time. And the expectation is that it won't last. South Vietnam will go down the tube. But we will have distanced ourselves somewhat from it. Then the next day you'd get somebody who'd come through and they'd say, no, Kissinger really believes in this. He believes that given a fair, you have to have a little luck, but it does stand a chance to work. He also argues that legally it is an absolute unassailable argument because under the agreement, if nothing else was clear, it was the North Vietnamese were not legally supposed to bring, or could not legally bring new forces into South Vietnam. Therefore, they would simply atrophy and wither as time went, the 40,000 we're talking about, would get old and go home or die, or the force would shrink. You could not augment the force. Could not go through Laos, could not go across the DMZ. There's no way to get, legally, to get reinforcements in there. And therefore, if they had stuck to this, which Kissinger thought they would because of pressure on them, this thing would have been over. Also, I think Kissinger felt that the threat of, which I would support him on this, of returning B-52s was enough to keep the political balance in Hanoi on the kind of dead center between the so-called doves and hawks, so there would not be a resumption of the war. Therefore, this is Kissinger's main argument today, and incidentally he's going to be on Nightline, Ted Koppel's Nightline, along with a bunch of other people on the 26th on U.S. recognition of Vietnam. They want people to come to New York to ask them questions for this, but they called me and asked me, but said, you've got to pay your own way. well, if you know of anybody who's in New York wants to go on the show on the 26th, let me know. I'll call ABC and give them your name. So I put this to Lord. Here are authoritative inside sources who say Kissinger was very cynical or Kissinger really believed that this thing could work. And what is the truth? And he said, both of the above, that Kissinger in those days, literally from day to day, would sort of go from euphoric to dysphoric. One day he'd be, saying very privately, there's no hope, this isn't going to work. Next day he's saying, I really think it is going to work now. And now that's not as unreasonable as you might expect, because given something that is so dynamic, so changing, so many forces, you can't see it clearly. And so your own sort of personal, and he wanted desperately for it to work, of course. And that's what you have to guard against, is your optimism. We have the same thing in Cambodia today. Can you establish peace or not? and all your, and I hope that you can, and so I have to steel myself not to look at this through rosy-colored glasses because I want it to happen, and try to see as it really is. And when it's all over, it's obvious that it was going one way or the other, but it's not at all obvious right now. And so all that saying, of course, Kissinger was human. He didn't have it completely straight. It's not much help making kind of a judgment. Okay. I don't know whether I've got some more here on assessment, but...
Are you going to talk about the Christmas bonding?
Yeah, that was what was in this section. What happened, you know, I guess that is important enough to say a bit on. The last agreement, was the Paris agreements were nailed down pretty much by late November of 72. And there was, all the articles had been agreed on and initialed in the margin, and Chu had been a very big problem on this. The emissaries of Washington kept going out, twisting his arm, and he finally agreed to go along. And at that point, that's when Kissinger made his famous pieces at hand press conference. Again, really believed at that point the thing was. And at that point, the North Vietnamese came in with about three more codicils that they wanted added. They weren't all that important, but they were obviously, we think we've reached an agreement, and suddenly they say, well, we forgot to mention they have some other things we want to put into this. And so Kissinger then, that allegedly, I don't know if this is ever told, actually true or not, said this is going to have a very bad effect on President Nixon, the mad bomber type. He's a little shaky on the edges, and boy, I don't know how he's going to take this, and he may land on you with both feet and so on. And this was supposedly the good cop, bad cop treatment. Anyway, they stuck with it, and at that rate, eventually there began these 9 days of all-out airstrikes, the so-called Christmas bombings over Christmas 1972. The first time the so-called smart bombs were used, the laser-guided bombs, for the first time there was no holds barred on targets. And I think the North Vietnamese perception had been that they had taken the worst punishment American air power could deliver, when in fact American air power was only being delivered to the communication and transportation matrix. Also, they thought that the precision bombing was about as great as it could be, and here was a whole new generation of it. And so it gave in the North Vietnamese a taste of air war such as they had never seen before, never really imagined, I think. And so at that point, they dropped the three codicils, went back to the original agreement and signed it. And of course, that has left the residue of, if we had done that in 65, the war would have been over in 65. The counter-argument being that the issues involved in 65 were not the same as in 72. That is, in 72, you can imagine the so-called doves in the Politburo saying, we are taking enormous punishment here for nothing, just for a few lousy paragraphs on a paper, which would not be the case in 65, which would have been capitulation. That's what you have to do as a price to stop the bombing. Nevertheless, it's one of these things that went on. You can argue it either way or not. I think it was just a case of the North Vietnamese leadership being too smart by half. We've got these guys where we want, now we can stick it to them a little more. And Nixon, the mad bomber, stuck it to them. And so then they said, okay, if that's the way it's going to be, we'll go back to the original. But the stakes involved there did not amount to much at all. A number of people died. The majority of North Vietnamese who died from airstrikes died in that 8-day period. It's not a large figure, but more died at that period than in the whole airstrike war up to that point. Anything is that clear? This episode.
Were there targets there?
Everything, almost. I mean, there was great bombing restrictions on target, what they call target acquisition, and now it was anything that you think should be bombed, can be bombed. I mean, you do not bomb hospitals and leprosariums and schools deliberately, but there is no restrictions. So they bombed the French embassy. They claimed it was a mistake, but probably was. I don't know.
Could you say something about these smart bombs? Really what they...
Well, they're laser guided, and as I understand it, there's two kinds. There's one in which you fix on the target through a red disc type. You've probably seen this on late movies where there's a red spot appears on the shooter. It's a red light that goes out, but it's a laser light, and it fixes on the target, and it's built into the bomb. So once the bomb is released, it will go right into the target. I mean, it'll target itself. And the other is a laser guided type, which is you fix it on the red spot on the target, and then you launch. It's a rocket usually, but you have to keep it on target. You keep the little red light on the target while it's coming in. And if it's still on the target when it gets there, but it's incredibly precise. I mean, literally one side of the street or the other. I don't know how strategically important this is, but it certainly impressed the North Vietnamese. And I talked to, POWs or defectors later about having been in Hanoi, and that was the sense of, my God, we never thought air war could be this way. Yeah.
Maybe I didn't hear this, but could you give us dates, rough dates for the War of Flags period?
Well, it began almost immediately with the signing of the Paris Agreements in February and March. There were a bunch of them of 73, and continued until the collapse really began and the disintegration, which was really January of 75.
That was pretty well sort of small-scale battles.
Very small-scale.
Village.
And not a large, I mean, the casualty rate dropped. And a lot of the world, particularly the Americans left, and a lot of the journalists left, and a lot of the world, in effect, got the impression the war was more or less over. Not relative to that, I guess it was, but it was still it was really back to kind of revolutionary guerrilla war, but with guerrillas really on both sides. There was a lot of paramilitary on both sides. The RFPF would run operations into Viet Cong-controlled villages like guerrillas. I mean, it was a very strange war.
I know you said it's sort of a what-if situation. What's your personal view? Do you think that, like when we use, the person's bombing, was so effective that could we have pressed for, push Hanoi to make decisions that it felt, and you say it went to the negotiations saying we're only willing to give up this, but
right.
They felt that if we had pressed them harder. And
well, I think they'd have thought that's a new ball game. It's all right, we're willing to forego what these things that we agreed to not have in the first place, but if you're asking about something else, that's a different matter. The only strong feeling I have on this is that I'm convinced that this so-called hawk-dove split in the Politburo, the North Vietnamese were not all that warlike, and they got sucked into really pursuing a kind of fanatical type war in pursuit of their objective that they didn't really want to, and that they would have been quite willing to pursue reunification under a different scenario. And that in fact what had happened was that had been became the sense of the Politburo. And the predominant sense was we do not want to go back to big unit war. Or we're not going to, and there are other ways to achieve our objective. And then came Watergate, and then came General Giap or whoever, they're not too sure, coming back and saying, I can guarantee you the B-52s are not, the Americans are out of this, just one last push and it'll be all over. And so the people who didn't even want to do this could go along with it saying, all right, you've sold us that bill of goods before, but we'll try it one more time. If they had never been able to have have that, if the American credibility had maintained, I think that the doves, if you will, would have prevailed in the Politburo, and we would have had a true ceasefire. And I think gradually then there could have been a coming together of North and South Vietnam over a long period of time within the framework of a federation of Indochina or a confederation in which everybody would really wind up getting what they want. And South Vietnam would have had to move toward a sort of left-leaning, not a Nguyen Van Thieu government, but a kind of Cambodian, non-aligned, neutralist Vietnam, which was feasible. I mean, it wasn't all that.
Do you really think, I mean, considering what you said about just the, you know, the Vietnamese penchant for not trusting anybody, combined with, I just saw the people that was kicked out for sort of soft on China, do you really think that even under those circumstances that something could have been negotiated that would have really satisfied the loyalists?
That's where, you know, your hopes and your wishes begin to cloud your judgment. And I don't know, so I wrote, as I say, I wrote a book, sort of written the ego here, I wrote a book saying this would be possible. So I offered it as a thesis, I didn't really, but I don't know, maybe you're right. This is this old, can anybody control history, or is it one huge river of events and we're all going down it with, you know, without a paddle. Okay. Here are, let's see, David Piper, Mark Walker, Allison Davis. Any of you know these people and want to take them along, you can. John Cullen, David Maltby, all right. Chris Cruz. Chris Cruz, May Chan, John Elsey, Raymond Wong, Dana Santos, Fong Dai Nguyen, or Nguyen Dai Fong, Lin Fong Dai, Thomas Frelston, Steve Harris, Daniel Mason, Suzanne Merson.
Thank you.
Gregory Lauren, David Mandel, very good. Victoria Anderson,
this is me.
Sony Alexander.
Yes.
How did you grade these so fast?
You're a fast reader.
Most people take 2 weeks to get them back. 3 weeks.
In rows.
This?
No.
Stephen Losh. Derek Rose, Aaron Barnes.
Actually, that's a friend of mine. I can take that.
All right. Nguyen Quang Din, Karen Hollerud, Cynthia Hine. It's only, what's her name?
I'm David Piper. You read it
earlier. Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Okay.
Great. Thank you very much.
All right.